Some Eastern Christians still linked the marking of Easter to the Jewish date of Passover, and the Roman government, seeking to disconnect Christianity from Judaism, took pains to prevent Christians from connecting themselves to the Jewish calendar in any way. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 114, Hillel II and the Coming of Constantine. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. All men think all men mortal but themselves. Themselves when some alarming shock of fate strikes through their wounded heart the sudden dread, but their hearts wounded like the wounded air soon close. Where past the shaft no trace is found, as from the wing no scar the sky retains, the parted wave no furrow from the keel. So dies in human hearts the thought of death. Even with the tender tears which nature sheds o'er those we love, we drop it in their grave. Thus the English poet Edward Young once reflected about how so many see the fact of mortality, yet so rarely apply it to themselves. If this is true about human beings in general, it is doubly true, often, about powerful leaders that changed the world they led. To read about Roosevelt, FDR, is to be struck by the fact that this frail but enormously powerful man gave every thought to winning the war and to redefining the world order, but seemingly very little thought to the possibility that he might die and that his vice president would define not only the nature of his legacy, but the future of the world. When one reads American history of the 1940s, one is struck by how Roosevelt did not seem to care all that much whether his vice president would be Douglas or Truman. And one realizes that only a man who did not conceive of the very real possibility that he would die 4 months into his fourth term did not give the choice of his successor any real thought. Churchill, in a somewhat similar sense, at the age of 80, refused to retire, refused to make way for the next generation. As I noted in my lectures on Avot, this cannot be said about the man who oversaw the composition of the Mishnah in the most successful Jewish era during the Roman reign, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch, Rabbi Yudah Nasi. Rabbi Judah knew that he was great. The Talmud records as pondering the possibility that some of the laws of the kings in the Torah would apply to him. A descendant of Hillel, and therefore a descendant of King David, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch was the closest Israel came in its leadership during this era to the restoration of the Davidic dynasty. Yet unlike many other leaders, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch was known not only for his greatness, but also for his humility. And the greatest indication of this humility is the fact that he balanced his honest understanding of his extraordinary achievements with an equally impressive ability to imagine a world in which he no longer lived. And this, in turn, marked an aspect of his family's leadership from his own age until over a century later, when the Constantinian Christian Empire came into being, ushering in a whole new period in the precarious Jewish position in the Holy Land and Jerusalem. The second chapter of the Mishnaic composition known as Avot gives us the moral maxims of Rabbi Judah the Patriarch. And then, after Rabbi Judah is described, we are told of his successor, his son, Rabban Gamliel. This seems initially odd because, as we have mentioned, it is usually assumed that Rabbi Judah was the author of the Mishnah and therefore of Avot. And yet here we have a description of the man who lived and led after him. I have suggested in my lectures on Avot that Rabbi Judah the Patriarch listed his son as a successor, thereby providing us in the Mishnah with a sort of living will. After all, according to the Talmud, Rabbi Judah the Patriarch had two sons, Gamliel and Shimon, with the second seemingly even more noted for his scholarship. But Rabbi Judah apparently felt that his elder son Gamliel was better suited for the political aspects of the position of patriarch. And if this is the case, then in Avot, Rabbi Judah, essentially prepares for an age in which he will no longer be alive. This is all the more remarkable when we realize all that the age of Rabbi Judah marked. As we have mentioned, it was during the period of Rabbi Judah's leadership that the dynasty of Septimus Severus eased the Roman persecution of the Jews, allowing for relative tranquility to be experienced by the practitioners of Judaism in the Galilee, as well as for the Mishnah to be composed by Rabbi Judah. So impactful was the age of Rabbi Judah that, according to the Talmud, his colleagues, the other rabbis, refused to imagine a world in which Rabbi Judah did not lead them. Thus, according to the Talmudic tale, as the great rabbi lay in his deathbed, his colleagues continued to pray, thereby keeping Rabbi Judah alive. Only Rabbi Judah's maid, seeing the terrible pain in which Rabbi Judah found himself, understood that his time had come. She therefore threw a vessel from the roof, shattering it, distracting the rabbis, pausing their prayer and allowing for Rabbi Judah's soul to depart. The larger symbolic meaning of the story is clear. Rabbi Judah's age marked an exception in the Jewish experience of Roman reign, so that the rabbis were terrified of what would follow. In Avot, Rabbi Judah tells us who his successor will be, and thereby communicates that he is willing to face what others could not. He was prepared to contemplate his own death and to prepare for a world without himself in it. It's with this in mind that we can then track the family of Rabbi Judah over the next century and a half, as the pagan Romans continued to dominate Jerusalem, as Rabbinic Judaism continued to endure, and as Jerusalem remained the paganized city, Aelia Capitolina. Rabbi Judah was indeed succeeded by his son, Rabban Gamliel, who in turn was followed by his son, also named Judah, colloquially called Rabbi Yehuda Nasiah. He in turn was followed by another member of this family dynasty, Hillel II. It was in this Hillel's lifetime that one of the most dramatic changes occurred, not only in the history of Jerusalem, but the world, Constantine's adoption of Christianity as the religion of the Roman Empire in the first part of the 4th century CE. In the process, as we'll discuss at greater length tomorrow, Jerusalem was converted into a Christian city, and the many pagan temples originally there were taken down and replaced. Yet the depaganization of Jerusalem did not mean a more positive experience for Jews in the region. On the contrary, the apparent closeness of the roots of the two faiths meant that the newly Christian empire sought to distinguish itself from the people and religion that gave the Hebrew Bible to the world. As Martin Goodman tells us, quote, "If any Jews did react with such optimism to the conversion of Constantine and the Christianization of Jerusalem, they were gravely deceived." Over the following decades of the 4th century, the leaders of the Jerusalem church bolstered their position within the Christian world, not least by virulent hostility to Jews and Judaism. When, on 7 May 351, a cross, flashing and sparkling with brilliant light, was seen in the sky above Jerusalem, the bishop of Jerusalem, Cyril, informed the emperor, Constantine's son Constantinus, that the sign signified that the Son of Man was coming to judge the enemies of the church, and that these enemies were the Jews. End quote. In other words, two events went hand in hand that had dramatic implications for the Jews in the Roman Empire. First, Christianity became the state religion, and second, the state took pains to disconnect itself and its state faith from any connection to Judaism. It is with this development in mind that we can ponder a moment in the Constantinian period that marked an important development in the history of Judaism. Up till this point, the calculation of the Jewish calendar had been set by the Sanhedrin, which in turn was overseen by the patriarch, the Nasi. This was done based on the arrival of witnesses every month, witnesses that testified to the sighting of the moon. Messengers were then sent throughout the diaspora informing Jewish communities of every major important calendrical development throughout the year, such as when Passover would occur. But suddenly, in the age of Hillel II, all of this ended. Hillel declared that a permanent calendar would be put into place, a cyclical one that could be easily calculated so that it could be observed by Jews around the world without monthly or yearly communication from the Sanhedrin in the Holy Land. How Hillel, according to Jewish law, was able to make the switch is a fascinating question beyond the scope of this lecture. But it bears noting that this was, as historians point out, an incredible relinquishing of his own power. Rabbi Dr. Saul Lieberman connected this decision by Hillel to events within the newly Christian empire. Some Eastern Christians still linked the marking of Easter to the Jewish date of Passover, and the Roman government, seeking to disconnect Christianity from Judaism, took pains to prevent Christians from connecting themselves to the Jewish calendar in any way. This, in turn, led to the empire being incentivized to prevent the communications from the Sanhedrin informing the diaspora about the coming of the month of Nisan, the month of Passover. Had this been but a temporary challenge, then, Rabbi Dr. Lieberman writes, Hillel would not have relinquished his authority. But Hillel apparently saw that in the future, Rome would be Christian, and Rome would be constantly incentivized to prevent the popularization by the Jews of the Passover date. Rabbi Dr. Lieberman puts it this way, quote, "Many churches in the East used to celebrate Easter during the week of Passover. The Council of Nicaea decided to do away with this Jewish practice and tried to achieve unity among the churches with respect to the date of Easter." He further adds that it seems that the government was quite determined in its efforts to prevent the patriarch from sending information regarding the dates of the holidays. And he adds, "Realizing that this prohibition, unlike any other, was conceived not to annoy the Jews, but to achieve that unity of such vital importance to the Christian government. The patriarch, meaning Hillel, concluded that the measure was not a temporary one, and consequently created a permanent calendar. End quote. If this is the case, then strikingly, Hillel II made manifest a willingness to imagine a world without himself, and indeed a world wherein his own office no longer did what it once did. Soon after Hillel II, the Sanhedrin itself disappeared, apparently because the special form of ordination required for it ceased, and there was no one qualified to comprise this judicial body. But what would remain following Hillel II was a common calendar that was kept by Jews all over the world and which united Jews all over the world, so that every holiday Jews thousands of miles away from each other would not only celebrate as one, but would remember as one all that occurred in Jerusalem on that date so many years before. Thus, on Yom Kippur, Jews everywhere, every year, assembled and remembered the service in the temple of the high priest. On Passover, Jews all over the world sat at the Seder, remembered the Paschal Lamb, and concluded with next year in Jerusalem. And on every holiday, Jews in synagogues in every location on earth read from the Torah about the various offerings brought in the temple on that holiday and would imagine a world in which that would be restored. The disappearance of the Sanhedrin could have meant a disappearance of a unifying Judaism joining Jews in every location, but it did not. Hillel II is the last truly famous member of the Hillelian family, and few other rabbinic families had such an impact on Judaism over so many generations. But even this family eventually disappeared. All men think all men mortal but themselves. But Hillel II foresaw a time when he would no longer live, when his Sanhedrin would no longer oversee the calendar, and he made sure that the Jewish people remained bound by sacred time long after he was gone, a sacred time marked by Jews around the world, a sacred time marked, thanks to him, in Jerusalem today as well. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.